happened, he was so overwhelmed that he sat down again, drawing his head into his shoulders as if he wanted to disappear. But he made an effort over himself and got up and said, "She is dying. The doctors say there is no hope. I am entirely in your power. Only let me be here, though I am at your disposal. Alexey Alexandrovich, seeing Vronsky's tears, felt a rush of that nervous emotion always produced in him by the sight of other people's sufferings, and turning away his face, he moved hurriedly to the door without hearing the rest of the words. From the bedroom came the sound of Anna's voice saying something. Her voice was lively, animated, with exceedingly distinct intonations. Alexey Alexandrovich went into the bedroom and walked up to the bed. She was lying with her face turned toward him. Her cheeks were flushed crimson, her eyes glittered, her little white hands thrust out from the cuffs of her dressing gown were playing with the quilt, twisting it about. It seemed as though she were not only well and blooming, but in the happiest frame of mind. She was talking rapidly, musically, and with exceptionally correct articulation and expressive intonation. "Because, Alexey, I am speaking of Alexey Alexandrovich. What a strange and awful thing that both are Alexeys, isn't it? Alexey would not refuse me. I should forget. He would forgive. But why doesn't he come? He's so good, he doesn't know himself how good he is. Ah, my God, what pangs. Give me some water, quick. Oh, that will be bad for her, my little girl. Oh, very well, then. Give her to a nurse. Yes, I agree, it's better in fact. He'll be coming. It will hurt him to see her. Give her to the nurse." "Anna Arkadyevna, he has come. He is here," said the midwife, trying to attract her attention to Alexey Alexandrovich. "Oh, what nonsense," Anna went on, not seeing her husband. "No, give her to me. Give me my little one. He has not come yet. You say he won't forgive me because you don't know him. No one knows him. I'm the only one, and it was hard for me, even. I ought to know his eyes. Seryosha has just such eyes, and I can't bear to see them because of it. Has Seryosha had his dinner? I know everyone will forget to do it. He would not forget. Seryosha must be moved into the corner room, and Mariette must be asked to sleep with him." All of a sudden she shrank back and was silent and in terror, as though expecting a blow, as though to defend herself she raised her hands to her face. She had seen her husband. "No, no," she began, "I am not afraid of him. I am afraid of death. Alexey, come here. I am in a hurry because I've no time. I haven't long to live. The fever will begin directly and I shall understand nothing more. Now I understand. I understand it all. I see it all." Alexey Alexandrovich's wrinkled face wore an expression of suffering. He took her by the hand and tried to say something, but he could not utter it. His lower lip quivered, but he still went on struggling with his emotion, and only now and then glanced at her. And each time he glanced at her, he saw her eyes gazing at him with such passionate and exultant tenderness as he had never yet seen in them. "Wait a minute. You don't know. Stay a little. Stay." She stopped as though collecting her ideas. "Yes," she began. "Yes, yes, yes. This is what I wanted to say. Don't be surprised at me. I'm still the same. But there is another woman in me. I'm afraid of her. She loved that man, and I tried to hate you, and could not forget about her that used to be. That woman isn't myself. Now I'm my real self. I'm dying now. I know I shall die. Ask him. Even now I feel, see here, the weights on my feet, on my hands, on my fingers. My fingers, see how huge they are, but this will soon be all over. Only one thing I want. Forgive me quite. I'm terrible, but my nurse would tell me, the holy martyr, what was her name? She was worse. And I'll go to Rome, there's a wilderness, and there I shall be no trouble to anyone. Only I'll take Seryosha and the little one. No, you can't forgive me. I know it can't be forgiven. No, no, go away. You're too good." She held his hand in one burning hand while she pushed him away with the other. The nervous agitation of Alexey Alexandrovich kept increasing, and had by now reached such a point that he ceased to struggle with it. He he suddenly felt that what he had regarded as nervous agitation was, on the contrary, a blissful spiritual condition that gave him all at once a new happiness he had never known. He did not think that the Christian law, which he had been all his life trying to follow, enjoined on him to forgive and love his enemies, but a joyous feeling of love and forgiveness for his enemies filled his heart. He knelt down and, laying his head in the curve of her arm, which burned him as with fire through the sleeve, he sobbed like a little child. She put her arm around his head, which was beginning to grow bald, moved toward him, and with defiant pride lifted up her eyes. "That is he. I knew him. Now, goodbye, everyone, goodbye. They've come again. Why don't they go away? Oh, take these fur coats off me." The doctor unloosed her hands, carefully laying her on the pillow, and covered her up to the shoulders. She lay back submissively and looked before her with beaming eyes. "Remember one thing, that I needed nothing but forgiveness, and I want nothing more. Why doesn't he come?" she said, turning to the door toward Vronsky. "Do come, do come. Give him your hand." Vronsky came to the side of the bed and, seeing Anna, again hid his face in his hands. "Uncover your face. Look at him. He's a saint," she said. "Oh, uncover your face. Do uncover it," she said angrily. "Alexey Alexandrovich, do uncover his face. I want to see him." Alexey Alexandrovich took Vronsky's hands and drew them away from his face, which was awful with the expression of agony and shame upon it. "Give him your hand. Forgive him." Alexey Alexandrovich gave him his hand, not attempting to restrain the tears that streamed from his eyes. "Thank God. Thank God," she said. "Now everything is ready. Only to stretch my legs a little. There, that's capital. How badly these flowers are done. Not a bit like a violet," she said, pointing to the hangings. My God, when will it end? Give me some morphine. Doctor, give me some morphine. Oh, my God," and she tossed about on the bed. The doctor said it was puerperal fever, and that 99 chances in 100 it would end in death. The whole day long there was fever, delirium, and unconsciousness. At midnight the patient lay without consciousness and almost without pulse. The end was expected every minute. Vronsky had gone home, but in the morning he came to inquire, and Alexey Alexandrovich, meeting him in the hall, said, "Better stay, she might ask for you," and himself led him to his wife's boudoir. Toward morning there was a return again of excitement, rapid thought and talk, and again it ended in unconsciousness. On the third day it was the same thing, and the doctor said there was hope. That day Alexey Alexandrovich went into the boudoir where Vronsky was sitting, and closing the door sat down opposite him. "Alexey Alexandrovich," said Vronsky, feeling that a statement of the situation was coming, "I can't speak. I can't understand. Spare me. However hard it is for you, believe me, it is more terrible for me." He would have risen, but Alexey Alexandrovich took him by the hand and said, "I beg you to hear me out. It is necessary. I must explain my feelings, the feelings that have guided me and will guide me, so that you may not be in error regarding me. You know I had resolved on a divorce and had even begun to take proceedings. I won't conceal from you that in beginning this I was in uncertainty. I was in misery. I will confess that I was pursued by a desire to revenge myself on you and on her. When I got the telegram, I came here with the same feelings. I will say more. I longed for her death, but..." He paused, pondering whether to disclose or not to disclose his feelings. "But I saw her and forgave her, and the happiness of forgiveness has revealed to me my duty. I forgive completely. I would offer the other cheek. I would give my cloak if my coat be taken. I pray to God only not to take from me the bliss of forgiveness." Tears stood in his eyes, and the luminous, serene look in them impressed Vronsky. "This is my position. You can trample me in the mud, make me the laughingstock of the world. I will not abandon her, and I will never utter a word of reproach to you," Alexey Alexandrovich went on. "My duty is clearly marked for me. I ought to be with her, and I will be. If she wishes to see you, I will let you know. But now I suppose it would be better for you to go away." He got up, and sobs cut short his words. Vronsky, too, was getting up, and in a stooping, not yet erect posture, looked up at him from under his brows. He did not understand Alexey Alexandrovitch's feeling, but he felt that it was something higher and even unattainable for him with his view of life. Chapter 18. After the conversation with Alexey Alexandrovitch, Vronsky went out on the steps of the Karenins' house and stood still, with difficulty remembering where he was and where he ought to walk or drive. He felt disgraced, humiliated, guilty, and deprived of all possibility of washing away his humiliation. He felt thrust out of the beaten track along which he had so proudly and lightly walked till then. All the habits and rules of his life that had seemed so firm had turned out suddenly false and inapplicable. The betrayed husband, who had figured till that time as a pitiful creature, an incidental and somewhat ludicrous obstacle to his happiness, had suddenly been summoned by her herself, elevated to an awe-inspiring pinnacle, and on the pinnacle that husband had shown himself, not malignant, not false, not ludicrous, but kind and straightforward and grand. Vronsky could not but feel this, and the roles were suddenly reversed. Vronsky felt the other's elevation and his own abasement, the other's truth and his own falsehood. He felt that the husband was magnanimous, even in his sorrow, while he had been base and petty in his deceit. But this sense of his own humiliation before the man he had unjustly despised made up only a small part of his misery. He felt unutterably wretched now for his passion for Anna, which had seemed to him of late to be growing cooler, now that he knew he had lost her forever, was stronger than ever it had been. He had seen all of her in her illness, had come to know her very soul, and it seemed to him that he had never loved her till then. And now, when he had learned to know her, to love her as she should be loved, he had been humiliated before her and had lost her forever, leaving her nothing of himself but a shameful memory. Most terrible of all had been his ludicrous, shameful position when Alexey Alexandrovitch had pulled his hands away from his humiliated face. He stood on the steps of the Karenins' house like one distraught and did not know what to do. "A hack, sir?" asked the porter. "Yes, a hack." On getting home after three sleepless nights, Vronsky, without undressing, lay prone on the sofa, clasping his hands and laying his head on them. His head was heavy. Images, memories, and ideas of the strangest description followed one another with extraordinary rapidity and vividness. First it was the medicine he had poured out for the patient and spilled out of the spoon, then the midwife's white hands, then the queer posture of Alexey Alexandrovitch on the floor beside the bed. "To sleep, to forget," he said to himself with the serene confidence of a healthy man, that if he is tired and sleepy, he will go to sleep at once. In the same instant his head did begin to feel drowsy and began to drop off into forgetfulness. The waves of the sea of unconsciousness had begun to meet over his head when all at once it seemed as though a violent shock of electricity had passed over him. He started so that he leaped up on the springs of the sofa and, leaning on his arms, got on his knees in a fright. His eyes were wide open as though he had never been asleep. The heaviness in his head and the flabbiness in his limbs that he had felt a minute before had suddenly gone. "You may trample me in the mud," he heard Alexey Alexandrovitch's words, and saw him standing before him and saw Anna's face, with its burning flush and glittering eyes, gazing with love and tenderness, not at him, but at Alexey Alexandrovitch. He saw his own, as he fancied, foolish and ludicrous figure when Alexey Alexandrovitch had taken his hands away from his face. He stretched out his legs again and flung himself on the sofa in the same position and shut his eyes. To sleep," he repeated to himself, but with his eyes shut he saw more distinctly than ever Anna's face, as it had been on the memorable evening before the races. "This cannot and will not be, and she wants to wipe it out of her memory, but I cannot live without it. How can we be reconciled? How can we be reconciled? He said aloud, and unconsciously began to repeat these words. This repetition of words checked the rising of fresh images and memories, which he felt were thronging in his brain. But repeating words did not check his imagination for long. Again, an extraordinarily rapid succession. His best moments rose before his mind, and then his recent humiliation. Take away his hands, Anna's voice was saying. He takes away his hands and feels a shame-struck and idiotic expression of his face. He was still lying down trying to sleep, though he felt there was not the smallest hope of it, and kept repeating stray words from some chain of thought, trying by this to check the rising flood of fresh images. He listened and heard words repeated in a strange, mad whisper. You did not appreciate it, did not make enough of it. You did not appreciate it, did not make enough of it. What's this? Am I going out of my mind? He said to himself. Perhaps. What makes men go out of their minds? What makes men shoot themselves? He answered himself, and opening his eyes, he saw with wonder an embroidered cushion beside him, worked by Varya, his brother's wife. He touched the tassel of the cushion and tried to think of Varya, of when he had seen her last. But to think of anything extraneous was an agonizing effort. No, I must sleep. He moved the cushion up and pressed his head into it, but he had to make an effort to keep his eyes shut. He jumped up and sat down. That's all over for me, he said to himself. I must think what to do. What is left? His mind rapidly ran through his life apart from his love of Anna. Ambition? Serpukhovskoy? Society? The court? He could not come to a pause anywhere. All of it had had meaning before, but now there was no reality in it. He got up from the sofa, took off his coat, undid his belt, and uncovering his hairy chest to breathe more freely, walked up and down the room. This is how people go mad, he repeated, and how they shoot themselves to escape humiliation, he added slowly. He went to the door and closed it, and then with fixed eyes and clenched teeth, he went up to the table, took a revolver, looked it about, turned it to a loaded barrel, and sank into thought. For 2 minutes, his head bent forward with an expression of an intense effort of thought. He stood with the revolver in his hand, motionless, thinking. Of course, he said to himself, as though a logical, continuous, and clear chain of reasoning had brought him to an indubitable conclusion. In reality, this, of course, so convincing to him, was simply the result of repeating exactly the same circle of memories and images through which he had already passed 10 times during the last hour. There were the same memories of happiness lost forever, the same conception of the senselessness of everything to come in life, the same consciousness of humiliation. There was the same sequence of these images and emotions, too. Of course, he repeated, when for the third time his thought passed again round the same spellbound circle of memories and images, and putting the revolver to the left side of his chest, and twitching vigorously with his whole hand as though squeezing it in his fist. He pulled the trigger. He did not hear the sound of the shot, but a violent blow on his chest knocked him down. He tried to clutch at the edge of the table, dropped the revolver, staggered, and sat down on the ground, looking about him in astonishment. He did not recognize his room. As he looked up from the ground at the bent legs of the table, at the waste paper basket and the tiger skin rug, the hurried, creaking steps of his servant coming through the drawing room brought him to his senses. He made an effort at thought and was aware that he was on the floor, and seeing blood on the tiger skin rug and on his arm, he knew he had shot himself. Idiotic, missed, he said, fumbling after the revolver. The revolver was close beside him. He was groping farther off. Still groping for it, he stretched out to the other side, and not being strong enough to keep his balance, fell over, streaming with blood. The elegant, whiskered manservant, who used to be continually complaining to his acquaintances of the delicacy of his nerves, was so panic-stricken on seeing his master lying on the floor that he left him, losing blood while he ran for assistance. An hour later, Varya, his brother's wife, had arrived, and with the assistance of 3 doctors, whom she had sent for in all directions, and who all appeared at the same moment. She got the wounded man to bed and remained to nurse him. Chapter 19. The mistake made by Alexei Alexandrovich when preparing to see his wife, in having overlooked the possibility that her repentance might be sincere, and that he might forgive her, and she might not die, this mistake was 2 months after his return from Moscow, brought home to him in all its significance. But the mistake made by him had arisen not simply from his having overlooked that contingency, but also from the fact that, until the day of his interview with his dying wife, he had not known his own heart. At his sick wife's bedside, he had, for the first time in his life, given way to the feeling of sympathetic suffering always roused in him by the sufferings of others, and hitherto looked on by him with shame as a harmful weakness. And pity for her, and remorse for having desired her death, and most of all the joy of forgiveness, made him at once conscious, not simply of the relief of his own sufferings, but of a spiritual peace he had never experienced before. He suddenly felt that the very thing that was the source of his sufferings had become the source of his spiritual joy, that what had seemed insolvable while he was judging, blaming, and hating had become clear and simple when he forgave and loved. He forgave his wife and pitied her for her sufferings and her remorse. He forgave Vronsky and pitied him, especially after reports reached him of his despairing action. He felt more for his son than before, and he blamed himself now for having taken too little interest in him. But for the little newborn baby, he felt a quite peculiar sentiment, not of pity only, but of tenderness. At first, from a feeling of compassion alone, he had been interested in the delicate little creature, who was not his child, and who was neglected during her mother's illness, and would certainly have died if he had not troubled about her. And he did not himself observe how fond he became of her. He would go into the nursery several times a day and sit there for a long while, so that the nurse and wet nurses, who were at first afraid of him, got quite used to his presence. Sometimes for half an hour at a stretch he would sit silently gazing at the saffron-red, downy, wrinkled face of the sleeping baby, watching the movements of the frowning brows and the plump little hands with clenched fingers that rubbed the little eyes and bridge of the nose with the back of their palms. At such moments, particularly, Alexei Alexandrovich had a sense of perfect peace and inward harmony, and saw nothing extraordinary in his position, nothing that ought to be changed. But as time went on, he saw more and more distinctly that however natural the position now seemed to him, he would not long be allowed to remain in it. He felt that besides the blessed spiritual force controlling his soul, there was another, a brutal force, as powerful or more powerful, which controlled his life, and that this force would not allow him that humble peace he longed for. He felt that everyone was looking at him with inquiring wonder, that he was not understood, and that something was expected of him. Above all, he felt the instability and unnaturalness of his relations with his wife. When the softening effect of the near approach of death had passed away, Alexei Alexandrovich began to notice that Anna was afraid of him, ill at ease with him, and could not look him straight in the face. She seemed to be wanting, yet not daring, to tell him something, and as though foreseeing that their present relations could not continue, she seemed to be expecting something from him. Toward the end of February, Anna's baby daughter, who had also been named Anna, happened to fall ill. Alexei Alexandrovich was in the nursery in the morning, and leaving orders for the doctor to be sent for, he went to his office. On finishing his work, he returned home at 4. Going into the hall, he saw a handsome footman in a galloon livery and a bare fur cape holding a white furred cloak. "Who is here?" asked Alexei Alexandrovich. "Princess Lizaveta Fyodorovna Tverskaya," the footman answered, and it seemed to Alexei Alexandrovich that the fellow grinned. During all this difficult time, Alexei Alexandrovich had noticed that his worldly acquaintances, especially women, took a peculiar interest in him and his wife. He observed all these acquaintances with difficulty, concealing their mirth at something, the same mirth that he had perceived in the lawyer's eyes, and just now in the eyes of his footman. Everyone seemed somehow hugely delighted, as though just come from a wedding. When they met him, they inquired with ill-disguised enjoyment after his wife's health. The presence of Princess Perskaya was unpleasant to Alexei Alexandrovich from the memories associated with her, and also because he disliked her, and he went straight to the nursery. In the day nursery, Seriosha, leaning on the table with his legs on a chair, was drawing and chatting away merrily. The English governess, who had, during Anna's illness, replaced the French one, was sitting near the boy, knitting mignardises. She hurriedly got up, curtsied, and pulled Seriosha. Alexei Alexandrovich stroked his son's hair, answered the governess's inquiries about his wife, and asked what the doctor had said of the baby. "The doctor said it was nothing serious, and he ordered a bath, sir." "But she is still in pain," said Alexei Alexandrovich, listening to the baby screaming in the next room. "I think it's the wet nurse, sir," the Englishwoman said firmly. "What makes you think so?" he asked, stopping short. "It's just as it was at Countess Paul's, sir. They gave the baby medicine, and it turned out that the baby was simply hungry. The wet nurse had no milk, sir." Alexei Alexandrovich pondered, and after standing still a few seconds, he went in at the other door. The baby was lying with its head thrown back, stiffening itself in the nurse's arms, and would not take the plump breast offered it, and it never ceased screaming in spite of the double hushing of the wet nurse and the other nurse who was bending over her. "Still no better," said Alexei Alexandrovich. "She's very restless," answered the nurse in a whisper. "Miss Edwards says that perhaps the wet nurse has no milk," he said. "I think so too, Alexei Alexandrovich." "Then why didn't you say so?" "Who's one to say it to?" "Anna Arkadyevna is still ill," said the nurse discontentedly. The nurse was an old servant of the family, and in her simple words there seemed to Alexei Alexandrovich an allusion to his position. The baby screamed louder than ever, struggling and choking. The nurse, with a gesture of despair, went to it, took it from the wet nurse's arms, and began walking up and down, rocking it. "You must ask the doctor to examine the wet nurse," said Alexei Alexandrovich. The smartly dressed and healthy-looking nurse, frightened at the idea of losing her place, muttered something to herself and, covering her bosom, smiled contemptuously at the idea of doubts being cast on her abundance of milk. In that smile, too, Alexei Alexandrovich saw a sneer at his position. "Luckless child," said the nurse, hushing the baby, and still walking up and down with it. Alexei Alexandrovich sat down and, with a despondent and suffering face, watched the nurse walking to and fro. While the child at last was still and had been put in a deep bed, and the nurse, after smoothing the little pillow, had left her, Alexei Alexandrovich got up and, walking awkwardly on tiptoe, approached the baby. For a minute he was still, and with the same despondent face gazed at the baby, but all at once a smile that moved his hair and the skin of his forehead came out on his face, and he went as softly out of the room. In the dining room he rang the bell and told the servant who came in to send again for the doctor. He felt vexed with his wife for not being anxious about this charming baby, and in this vexed humor he had no wish to go to her. He had no wish either to see Princess Betsy. But his wife might wonder why he did not go to her as usual, and so, overcoming his disinclination, he went toward her bedroom. As he walked over the soft rug toward the door, he could not help overhearing a conversation he did not want to hear. "If he hadn't been going away, I could have understood your refusal and his too, but your husband ought to be above that," Betsy was saying. "It's not for my husband, it's for myself, I don't wish it." "Don't say that," answered Anna's excited voice. "Yes, but you must care to say goodbye to a man who has shot himself on your account." "That's just why I don't want to." With a dismayed and guilty expression, Alexei Alexandrovich stopped and would have gone back unobserved. But reflecting that this would be undignified, he turned back again, and clearing his throat, he approached the bedroom. The voices were silent, and he went in. Anna, in a gray dressing gown with a crop of short, clustering black curls on her round head, was sitting on a settee. The animation died out of her face, as it always did at the sight of her husband. She dropped her head and looked round uneasily at Betsy. Betsy, dressed in the height of the latest fashion, in a hat that towered over her head like a shade on a lamp, in a dove-colored dress with crude oblique stripes slanting one way on the bodice and the other way on the skirt, was sitting beside Anna. Her tall, flat figure held erect. Bowing her head, she greeted Alexei Alexandrovich with an ironical smile. "Ah," she said, as though surprised, "I'm very glad you're at home. You never put in an appearance anywhere, and I haven't seen you ever since Anna has been ill. I have heard all about it, your anxiety." "Yes, you're a wonderful husband," she said, with a significant and affable air, as though she were bestowing an order of magnanimity on him for his conduct toward his wife. Alexei Alexandrovich bowed frigidly and, kissing his wife's hand, asked how she was. "Better, I think," she said, avoiding his eyes. "But you've rather a feverish complexion," he said, laying stress on the word feverish. "We've been talking too much," said Betsy. "I feel it's selfishness on my part, and I am going away." She got up, but Anna, suddenly flushing, quickly caught at her hand. "No, wait a minute, please. I must tell you. No, I mean you." She turned to Alexei Alexandrovich, and her neck and brow were suffused with crimson. "I won't and can't keep anything secret from you," she said. Alexei Alexandrovich cracked his fingers and bowed his head. "Betsy's been telling me that Count Vronsky wants to come here to say goodbye before his departure for Tashkent." She did not look at her husband and was evidently in haste to have everything out, however hard it might be for her. "I told her I could not receive him." "You said, my dear, that it would depend on Alexei Alexandrovich," Betsy corrected her. "Oh, no, I can't receive him. And what object would there be in it?" She stopped suddenly and, glancing inquiringly at her husband, he did not look at her. "In short, I don't wish it." Alexei Alexandrovich advanced and would have taken her hand. Her first impulse was to jerk back her hand from the damp hand with big swollen veins that saw hers, but with an obvious effort to control herself, she pressed his hand. "I am very grateful to you for your confidence, but," he said, feeling with confusion and annoyance that what he could decide easily and clearly by himself, he could not discuss before Princess Tverskaya, who to him stood for the incarnation of that brute force which would inevitably control him in the life he led in the eyes of the world, and hinder him from giving way to his feeling of love and forgiveness. He stopped short, looking at Princess Tverskaya. "Well, goodbye, my darling," said Betsy, getting up. She kissed Anna and went out. Alexei Alexandrovich escorted her. "Alexei Alexandrovich, I know you are truly a magnanimous man," said Betsy, stopping in the little drawing room and with special warmth shaking hands with him once more. "I am an outsider, but I love her so and respect you that I venture to advise. Receive him. Alexei Vronsky is a soul of honor, and he is going away to Tashkent. Thank you, Princess, for your sympathy and advice. But the question of whether my wife can or cannot see anyone, she must decide herself." He said this from habit, lifting his brows with dignity, and reflected immediately that whatever his words might be, there could be no dignity in his position. And he saw this by the suppressed, malicious, and ironical smile with which Betsy glanced at him after this phrase. Chapter 20. Alexei Alexandrovich took leave of Betsy in the drawing room and went to his wife. She was lying down, but hearing his steps, she sat up hastily in her former attitude and looked in a scared way at him. He saw that she had been crying. "I am very grateful for your confidence in me," he repeated gently in Russian the phrase he had said in Betsy's presence in French, and sat down beside her. When he spoke to her in Russian, using the Russian thou of intimacy and affection, it was insufferably irritating to Anna. "And I am very grateful for your decision. I, too, imagine that since he is going away, there is no sort of necessity for Count Vronsky to come here. However, if... But I've said so already, so why repeat it?" Anna suddenly interrupted him with an irritation she could not succeed in repressing. No sort of necessity, she thought, for a man to come and say goodbye to the woman he loves, for whom he was ready to ruin himself and has ruined himself, and who cannot live without him. No sort of necessity. She compressed her lips and dropped her burning eyes to his hands with their swollen veins. They were slowly rubbing each other. "Let us never speak of it," she added more calmly. "I have left this question to you to decide, and I am very glad to see," Alexei Alexandrovich was beginning. "That my wish coincides with your own," she finished quickly, exasperated as he was talking so slowly while she knew beforehand all he would say. "Yes," he assented, "and Princess Vorskaya's interference in the most difficult private affairs is utterly uncalled for. She especially." "I don't believe a word of what's said about her," said Anna quickly. "I know she really cares for me." Alexei Alexandrovich sighed and said nothing. She played nervously with the tassel of her dressing gown, glancing at him with that torturing sensation of physical repulsion for which she blamed herself, though she could not control it. Her only desire now was to be rid of his repelling presence. "I have just sent for the doctor," said Alexei Alexandrovich. "I am very well. What do I want the doctor for?" "No, the little one cries, and they say the wet nurse hasn't enough milk." "Why didn't you let me nurse her when I begged to?" "Anyway," Alexei Alexandrovich knew what was meant by that anyway, "she's a baby, and they're killing her. She rang the bell and ordered the baby to be brought her. I begged to nurse her. I wasn't allowed to, and now I'm blamed for it." "I don't blame." "Yes, you do blame me. My God, why didn't I die?" And she broke into sobs. "Forgive me. I'm nervous. I'm unjust," she said, controlling herself. "But do go away." "No, it can't go on like this," Alexei Alexandrovich said to himself resolutely as he left his wife's room. Never had the impossibility of his position in the world's eyes and his wife's hatred of him, and above all, the might of that mysterious, brutal force that guided his life against his spiritual inclinations in exacted conformity with its degrees and a change in his present attitude to his wife, never had it been presented to him with such distinctness as on that day. He saw clearly that all the world and Anna expected something of him, but what exactly he could not make out. He felt that this was rousing in his soul a feeling of anger, destructive of his peace of mind and of all the good of his achievement. He believed that for Anna herself it would be better to break off all relations with Vronsky. But if they all thought this out of the question, he was even ready to allow these relations to be renewed, so long as the children were not disgraced, and he was not deprived of them nor forced to change his position. Bad as this might be, it was at any rate better than a rupture, which would put her in a hopeless and shameful position, and deprive him of everything he cared for. But he felt helpless. He knew beforehand that everyone was against him, and that he would not be allowed to do what seemed to him now so natural and right, but would be forced to do what was wrong, though to them it seemed the proper thing. Before Betsy had time to walk out of the drawing room, she was met in the doorway by Stepan Arkadyevich, who had just come from Elisev's, where a consignment of fresh oysters had been received. "Ah, Princess, what a delightful meeting," he began. "I've been to see you." "A meeting for 1 minute, for I'm going," said Betsy, smiling and putting on her glove. "Don't put on your glove yet, Princess. Let me kiss your hand. There's nothing I am so thankful to the revival of the old fashions for as kissing the hand." He kissed Betsy's hand. "When shall we see each other?" "You don't deserve it," answered Betsy, smiling. "Oh, yes, I deserve a great deal, for I've become a most serious person. I not only manage my own domestic affairs, but other people's too," he said with a significant expression. "Oh, I'm so glad," answered Betsy, at once understanding that he was speaking of Anna. And going back into the drawing room, they stood in a corner. "He's killing her," said Betsy in a whisper full of meaning. "It's impossible, impossible." "I'm so glad you think so," said Stepan Arkadyevich, shaking his head with a serious and sympathetically distressed expression. "That's what I've come to Petersburg for." "The whole town's talking of it," she said. "It's an impossible situation. She pines and pines away. He doesn't understand that she's one of those women who can't trifle with their feelings. One of two things. Either let him take her away, act with energy, or give her a divorce. This is stifling her." "Yes, yes, just so," Oblonsky said, sighing. "That's what I've come for, at least not solely for that. I've been made a kammerherr. Of course, one has to give thanks, but the chief thing was having to settle this." "Well, God help you," said Betsy. After accompanying Betsy to the outside hall, once more kissing her hand above the glove at the point where the pulse beats, and murmuring to her such unseemly nonsense that she did not know whether to laugh or to be angry, Stepan Arkadyevich went to his sister. He found her in tears. Although he happened to be bubbling over with good spirits, Stepan Arkadyevich immediately and quite naturally fell into the sympathetic, poetically emotional tone which harmonized with her mood. He asked her how she was and how she had spent the morning. "Very, very miserably. Today and this morning and all past days and all the days to come," she said. "I think you're giving way to pessimism. You must rouse yourself. You must look life in the face. I know it's hard, but..." "I have heard it said that women love men even for their vices," Anna began suddenly. "But I hate him for his virtues. I can't live with him. Do you understand? The sight of him has a physical effect on me. I am beside myself from it. I can't live with him. What am I to do? I have been unhappy and used to think one couldn't be unhappier, but the awful state of things I am going through now I could never have conceived. Would you believe it, that knowing he's a good man, a splendid man, that I'm not worth his little finger, I still hate him? I hate him for his generosity, and there's nothing left for me but..." She would have said death, but Stepan Arkadyevich would not let her finish. "You are ill and overwrought," he said. "Believe me, you're exaggerating dreadfully. There's nothing so terrible in it." And Stepan Arkadyevich smiled. No one else in Stepan Arkadyevich's place, having to do with such despair, would have ventured to smile. The smile would have seemed brutal. But in his smile there was so much of sweetness and almost feminine tenderness that his smile did not wound, but softened and soothed. His gentle, soothing words and smiles were as soothing and softening as almond oil, and Anna soon felt this. "No, Stivish," she said, "I'm lost, lost, worse than lost. I can't say yet that all is over. On the contrary, I feel that it's not over. I'm an overstrained cord that must snap, but it's not ended yet, and it will have a fearful end." "No matter, we must let the cord be loosened little by little. There's no position from which there is no way of escape. I have thought and thought. Only one." Again he knew from her terrified eyes that this one way of escape in her thought was death, and he would not let her say it. "Not at all," he said. "Listen to me. You can't see your own position as I can. Let me tell you candidly my opinion." Again he smiled discreetly, his almond oil smile. "I'll begin from the beginning. You married a man 20 years older than yourself. You married him without love and not knowing what love was. It was a mistake, let's admit." "A fearful mistake," said Anna. "But I repeat, it's an accomplished fact. Then you had, let us say, the misfortune to love a man not your husband. That was a misfortune. But that, too, is an accomplished fact. And your husband knew it and forgave it." He stopped at each sentence, waiting for her to object, but she made no answer. "That's that. Now the question is, can you go on living with your husband? Do you wish it? Does he wish it?" "I know nothing, nothing." "But you said yourself that you can't endure him." "No, I didn't say so. I deny it. I don't know anything. I don't understand anything." "Yes, but let..." "You can't understand. I feel I'm lying head downward in a sort of pit, but I ought not to save myself. And I can't. Never mind. We'll slip something under you and pull you out. I understand you. I understand that you can't take it on yourself to express your wishes, your feelings." "There's nothing, nothing I wish, except for it all to be over." "But he sees this and knows it, and do you suppose it weighs on him any less than on you? You're wretched, he's wretched, and what good can come of it?" While divorce would solve the whole difficulty, with some effort Stepan Arkadyevich brought out his central idea and looked significantly at her. She said nothing and shook her cropped head in dissent, but from the look in her face that suddenly brightened into its former beauty, he saw that if she did not desire this, it was simply because it seemed to her an unattainable happiness. "I'm awfully sorry for you both, and how happy I should be if I could arrange things," said Stepan Arkadyevich, smiling more boldly. "Don't speak, don't say a word. God grant only that I may speak as I feel. I'm going to him." Anna looked at him with dreamy, shining eyes and said nothing. Chapter 22. Stepan Arkadyevich, with the same somewhat solemn expression with which he used to take his presidential chair at his board, walked into Alexey Alexandrovich's room. Alexey Alexandrovich was walking about his room with his hands behind his back, thinking of just what Stepan Arkadyevich had been discussing with his wife. "I'm not interrupting you," said Stepan Arkadyevich, on the sight of his brother-in-law becoming suddenly aware of a sense of embarrassment unusual with him. To conceal this embarrassment, he took out a newly purchased cigarette case that opened in a new way, and sniffing the leather, took a cigarette out of it. "No. Do you want anything?" Alexey Alexandrovich said reluctantly. "Yes, I wished. I wanted. Yes, I wanted to talk to you," said Stepan Arkadyevich, with surprise, aware of an unaccustomed timidity. This feeling was so unexpected and so strange that he did not believe it was the voice of conscience telling him that what he meant to do was wrong. Stepan Arkadyevich made an effort and struggled with the timidity that had come over him. "I hope you believe in my love for my sister and my sincere affection and respect for you," he said, reddening. Alexey Alexandrovich stood still and said nothing, but his face struck Stepan Arkadyevich by its expression of an unresisting sacrifice. "I wanted to have a little talk with you about my sister and your mutual position," he said, still struggling with an unaccustomed constraint. Alexey Alexandrovich smiled mournfully, looked at his brother-in-law, and without answering went up to the table, took from it an unfinished letter, and handed it to his brother-in-law. "I think unceasingly of the same thing, and here is what I had begun writing, thinking I could say it better by letter, and that my presence irritates her," he said, as he gave him the letter. Stepan Arkadyevich took the letter, looked with incredulous surprise at the lusterless eyes fixed so immovably on him, and began to read. "I see that my presence is irksome to you. Painful as it is to me to believe it, I see that it is so, and cannot be otherwise. I don't blame you, and God is my witness that on seeing you at the time of your illness, I resolved with my whole heart to forget all that had passed between us, and to begin a new life. I do not regret, and shall never regret, what I have done, but I have desired one thing, your good, the good of your soul, and now I see I have not attained that. Tell me yourself what will give you true happiness and peace to your soul. I put myself entirely in your hands and trust to your feeling of what is right." Stepan Arkadyevich handed back the letter and with the same surprise continued looking at his brother-in-law, not knowing what to say. This silence was so awkward for both of them that Stepan Arkadyevich's lips began twitching nervously, while he still gazed without speaking at Karenin's face. "That's what I wanted to say to her," said Alexey Alexandrovich, turning away. "Yes, yes," said Stepan Arkadyevich, not able to answer for the tears that were choking him. "Yes, yes, I understand you," he brought out at last. "I want to know what she would like," said Alexey Alexandrovich. "I am afraid she does not understand her own position. She is not a judge," said Stepan Arkadyevich, recovering himself. "She is crushed, simply crushed, by your generosity. If she were to read this letter, she would be incapable of saying anything. She would only hang her head lower than ever." "Yes, but what's to be done in that case? How explain? How find out her wishes?" "If you will allow me to give my opinion, I think that it lies with you to point out directly the steps you consider necessary to end the situation." "So you consider it must be ended?" Alexey Alexandrovich interrupted him. "But how?" he added, with a gesture of his hands before his eyes, not usual with him. "I see no possible way out of it." "There is some way of getting out of every situation," said Stepan Arkadyevich, standing up and becoming more cheerful. "There was a time when you thought of breaking off. If you are convinced now that you cannot make each other happy..." "Happiness may be variously understood, but I suppose that I agree to everything, that I want nothing. What way is there of getting out of our situation?" If you care to know my opinion, said Stepan Arkadyevitch with the same smile of softening almond oil tenderness with which he had been talking to Anna. His kindly smile was so winning that Alexey Alexandrovitch, feeling his own weakness and unconsciously swayed by it, was ready to believe what Stepan Arkadyevitch was saying. She will never speak out about it, but one thing is possible. One thing she might desire, he went on. That is the cessation of your relations and all memories associated with them. To my thinking, in your situation, the essential thing is the formation of a new attitude to one another, and that can only rest on a basis of freedom on both sides. Divorce? Alexey Alexandrovich interrupted in a tone of aversion. Yes, I imagine that divorce. Yes, divorce, Stepan Arkadyevitch repeated, reddening. That is, from every point of view, the most rational course for married people who find themselves in the situation you are in. What can be done if married people find that life is impossible for them together? That may always happen. Alexey Alexandrovich sighed heavily and closed his eyes. There's only one point to be considered. Is either of the parties desirous of forming new ties? If not, it is very simple, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, feeling more and more free from constraint. Alexey Alexandrovich, scowling with emotion, muttered something to himself and made no answer. All that seemed so simple to Stepan Arkadyevitch. Alexey Alexandrovich had thought over thousands of times, and so far from being simple, it all seemed to him utterly impossible. Divorce, the details of which he knew by this time, seemed to him now out of the question, because the sense of his own dignity and respect for religion forbade his taking upon himself a fictitious charge of adultery, and still more, suffering his wife, pardoned and beloved by him, to be caught in the fact and put to public shame. Divorce appeared to him impossible also on other still more weighty grounds. What would become of his son in case of a divorce? To leave him with his mother was out of the question. The divorced mother would have her own illegitimate family, in which his status as a stepson and his education would be probably bad. Keep him with him? He knew that would be an act of vengeance on his part, and that he did not desire. But apart from this, what more than all made divorce seem impossible to Alexey Alexandrovich was that, by consenting to a divorce, he would be completely ruining Anna. The saying of Darya Alexandrovna at Moscow, that in deciding on a divorce he was thinking of himself and not considering that this, he would be ruining her irrevocably, had sunk into his heart. And connecting this saying with his forgiveness of her, with his devotion to the children, he understood it now in his own way. To consent to a divorce, to give her her freedom, meant in his thoughts to take from himself the last tie that bound him to life, the children whom he loved, and to take from her the last prop that kept her on the path of right, to thrust her down to her ruin. If she were divorced, he knew she would join her life to Vronsky's, and their tie would be an illegitimate and criminal one, since a wife, by the interpretation of the ecclesiastical law, could not marry while her husband was living. She will join him, and in a year or two he will throw her over, or she will form a new tie, thought Alexey Alexandrovich. And I, by agreeing to an unlawful divorce, shall be to blame for her ruin. He had thought it all over hundreds of times and was convinced that a divorce was not as simple as Stepan Arkadyevitch had said, but was utterly impossible. He did not believe a single word Stepan Arkadyevitch said to him. To every word he had thousand objections to make, but he listened to him, feeling that his words were the expression of that mighty brutal force which controlled his life and to which he would have to submit. The only question is on what terms you agree to give her a divorce. She does not want anything, does not dare ask you for anything. She leaves it all to your magnanimity. My God, what for, thought Alexey Alexandrovich, remembering the details of divorce proceedings in which the husband took the blame on himself, and with just the same gesture with which Vronsky had done it, he hid his face in his hands in shame. You are troubled, I understand that. But if you think it over, And unto him that smiteth thee on the one cheek offer also the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take that coat also, thought Alexei Alexandrovitch. Yes, yes, he cried in a shrill voice, I will take the disgrace on myself. I will give up even my son, but wouldn't it be better to let it alone? Still, you may do as you like. And turning away so that his brother-in-law could not see him, he sat down on a chair at the window. There was bitterness, there was shame in his heart, but with bitterness and shame he felt joy and emotion at the height of his own meekness. Stepan Arkadyevitch was touched. He was silent for a space. Alexei Alexandrovitch, believe me, she appreciates your magnanimity, he said. But it seems it was the will of God, he added, and as he said it, felt how foolish a remark it was, and with difficulty repressed a smile at his own foolishness. Alexei Alexandrovitch would have made some reply, but tears stopped him. This is an unhappy fatality, and one must accept it as such. I accept the calamity as an accomplished fact, and am doing my best to help both her and you, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. When he went out to his brother-in-law's room, he was touched, but that did not prevent him from being glad he had successfully brought the matter to a conclusion, for he felt certain Alexei Alexandrovitch would not go back on his words. To this satisfaction was added the fact that an idea had just struck him for a conundrum turning on his successful achievement. When the affair was over, he would put it to his wife and most intimate friends. He tried this conundrum in two or three different ways. But I'll work it out better than that, he said to himself with a smile. Chapter 23. Vronsky's wound had been a dangerous one, though it did not touch the heart, and for several days he hovered between life and death. The first time he was able to speak, Varya, his brother's wife, was alone in the room. Varya, he said, looking sternly at her, I shot myself by accident, and please never speak of it, and tell everyone so, or else it's too ridiculous. Without answering his words, Varya bent over him and with a delighted smile gazed into his face. His eyes were clear, not feverish, but their expression was stern. Thank God, she said. You're not in pain? A little here, he pointed to his breast. Then let me change your bandages. In silence, stiffening his broad jaws, he looked at her while she bandaged him up. When she had finished, he said, I'm not delirious. Please manage that there may be no talk of my having shot myself on purpose. No one says so. Only I hope you won't shoot yourself by accident any more, she said, with a questioning smile. I think I won't, but it would have been better, and he smiled gloomily. In spite of these words and his smile, which so frightened Varya, when the inflammation was over and he began to recover, he felt that he was completely free from one part of his misery. By his action he had, as it were, washed away the shame and humiliation he had felt before. He could now think calmly of Alexei Alexandrovitch. He recognized all his magnanimity, but he did not now feel himself humiliated by it. Besides, he got back again into the beaten track of his life. He saw the possibility of looking men in the face again without shame, and he could live in accordance with his own habits. One thing he could not pluck out of his heart, though he never ceased struggling with it. The regret amounting to despair at having lost her forever. That, having expiated his sin against the husband, he was now bound to renounce her, and never in future to stand between her with her repentance and her husband. He had firmly decided in his heart, but he could not tear out of his heart his regret at the loss of her love. He could not erase from his memory those moments of happiness which he had known with her and had so little prized at the time, and which haunted him with all their charm. Serpukhovskoy had planned his appointment at Tashkent, and Vronsky agreed to the proposal without the slightest hesitation. But the nearer the time of departure came, the bitterer was the sacrifice he was making to what he thought his duty. His wound had healed, and he was driving about making preparations for his departure to Tashkent. To see her once and then to bury myself, to die, he thought, and as he was paying farewell visits, he uttered this thought to Betsy. Charged with his commission, Betsy had gone to Anna and brought him back a negative reply. So much the better, thought Vronsky when he received the news. It was a weakness which would have shattered what strength I have left. Next day, Betsy herself came to him in the morning and announced that she had heard through Oblonsky, as a positive fact, that Alexey Alexandrovich had agreed to a divorce, and that therefore Vronsky could see Anna. Without even troubling himself to see Betsy out of his flat, forgetting all his resolutions without asking when he could see her or where her husband was, Vronsky drove straight to the Karenins. He ran up the stairs, seeing no one and nothing, and with a rapid step, almost breaking into a run, he went into her room. And without considering, without noticing whether there was anyone in the room or not, he flung his arms round her and began to cover with kisses her face, her hands, her neck. Anna had been preparing herself for this meeting, had thought what she would say to him, but she did not succeed in saying anything. His passion mastered her. She tried to calm him, to calm herself, but it was too late. His feeling infected her. Her lips trembled so that for a long while she could say nothing. "Yes, you have conquered me, and I am yours," she said at last, pressing his hands to her bosom. "So it had to be," he said. "So long as we live, it must be so. I know it now." "That's true," she said, getting whiter and whiter and embracing his head. "Still, there is something terrible in it after all that has happened." "It will all pass. It will all pass. We shall be so happy. Our love, if only could be stronger, will be strengthened by there being something terrible in it," he said, lifting his head and showing his strong teeth in a smile. And she could not but respond with a smile, not to his words, but to the love in his eyes. She took his hand and stroked her chilled cheeks and cropped head with it. "I don't know you with this short hair. You've grown so pretty, a boy, but how pale you are." "Yes, I'm very weak," she said, smiling, and her lips began trembling again. "We'll go to Italy. You will get strong," he said. "Can it be possible we could be like husband and wife alone, our own family?" she said, looking close into his eyes. "It only seems strange to me that it can ever have been otherwise. Stiva says that he has agreed to everything, but I can't accept his magnanimity," she said, looking dreamily past Vronsky's face. "I don't want a divorce. It's all the same to me now, only I don't know what he will decide about Seriosha." He could not conceive how at this moment of their meeting she could remember and think of her son, of divorce. What did it all matter? "Don't speak of that. Don't think of it," he said, turning her hand in his and trying to draw her attention to him, but still she did not look at him. "Oh, why didn't I die? It would have been better," she said, and without sobbing, tears flowed down both her cheeks, but she tried to smile so as not to wound him. To decline the flattering and dangerous appointment at Tashkent would have been, Vronsky had till then considered disgraceful and impossible. But now, without an instant's consideration, he declined it, and observing dissatisfaction in the upper quarters after this step, he immediately retired from the army. A month later, Alexey Alexandrovich was left alone with his son in his house at Peterburg, while Anna had gone abroad with Vronsky, without having obtained a divorce, and having absolutely declined all idea of one. Part 5, Chapter 1. Princess Shcherbatskaya considered that it was out of the question for the wedding to take place before Lent, just 5 weeks off, since not half the trousseau could possibly be ready by that time. But she could not agree with Levin that to fix it for after Lent would be putting it off too late, as an old aunt of Prince Shcherbatsky's was seriously ill and might die, and then the mourning would delay the wedding still longer. And therefore, deciding to divide the trousseau into two parts, a larger and a smaller trousseau, the princess consented to have the wedding before Lent. She determined that she would get the smaller part of the trousseau already now, and the larger part should be sent on later. And she was much vexed with Levin because he was incapable of giving her a serious answer to the question whether he agreed to this arrangement or not. The arrangement was the more suitable as, immediately after the wedding, the newly married couple were to go to the country, where the belongings of the larger trousseau would not be wanted. Levin still continued in the same delirious condition in which it seemed to him that he and his happiness constituted the chief and sole aim of all existence, and that he need not now think or care about anything, that everything was being done and would be done for him by others. He had not even plans and aims for the future. He left its arrangement to others, knowing that everything would be delightful. His brother, Sergei Ivanovich, and Stepan Arkadyevich, and the princess, guided him in doing what he had to do. All he did was to agree entirely with everything suggested to him. His brother raised money for him. The princess advised him to leave Moscow after the wedding. Stepan Arkadyevich advised him to go abroad. He agreed to everything. Do what you choose if it amuses you. I am happy, and my happiness can be no greater and no less because of anything you do, he thought. When he told Kitty of Stepan Arkadyevich's advice that they should go abroad, he was much surprised that she did not agree to this and had some definite requirements of her own in regard to their future. She knew Levin had work he loved in the country. She did not, as he saw, understand his work. She did not even care to understand it. But that did not prevent her from regarding it as a matter of great importance. And therefore she knew their home would be in the country, and she wanted to go not abroad where she was not going to live, but to the place where their home would be. This definitely expressed purpose astonished Levin. But since he did not care either way, he immediately asked Stepan Arkadyevich, as though it were his duty, to go down to the country and to arrange everything there to the best of his ability, with that taste of which he had so much. But I say, Stepan Arkadyevich said to him one day after he had come back from the country where he had got everything ready for the young people's arrival, have you a certificate of having been at confession? No, but what of it? You can't be married without it. My, 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 cried Levin. Why, I believe it's 9 years since I've taken the sacrament. I never thought of it. You're a pretty fellow, said Stepan Arkadyevich, laughing, and you call me a nihilist? But this won't do, you know. You must take the sacrament. When? There are 4 days left now. Stepan Arkadyevich arranged this also, and Levin had to prepare himself for the sacrament. To Levin, as to any unbeliever who respects and believes of others, it was exceedingly disagreeable to be present at and to take part in church ceremonies. At this moment, in his present softened state of feeling, sensitive to everything, this inevitable act of hypocrisy was not merely painful to Levin, it seemed to him utterly impossible. Now in the heyday of his highest glory, his fullest flower, he would have to be a liar or a blasphemer. He felt incapable of being either. But though he repeatedly plied Stepan Arkadyevich with questions as to the possibility of obtaining a certificate without actually communicating, Stepan Arkadyevich maintained that it was out of the question. Besides, what is it to you, 2 days? And he's an awfully fine, clever old fellow. He'll pull the tooth out for you so gently you won't notice it. Standing at the first mass, Levin attempted to revive in himself his youthful recollections of the intense religious emotion he had passed through between the ages of 16 and 17. But he was at once convinced that it was utterly impossible to him. He attempted to look at it all as an empty custom, having no sort of meaning, like the custom of paying calls, but he felt that he could not do that either. Levin found himself, like the majority of his contemporaries, in the vaguest position in regard to religion. Believe he could not, and at the same time he had no firm conviction that it was all wrong, and consequently, not being able to believe in the significance of what he was doing, nor to regard it with indifference as an empty formality, during the whole period of preparing for the sacrament, he was conscious of a feeling of discomfort and shame at doing what he did not himself understand, and what, as an inner voice told him, was therefore false and wrong. During the service, he would first listen to the prayers, trying to attach some meaning to them not discordant with his own views. Then, feeling that he could not understand and must condemn them, he tried not to listen to them, but to attend to the thoughts, observations, and memories which floated through his brain with extreme vividness during this idle time of standing in church. He had stood through the Mass, the evening service, and the midnight service, and the next day he got up earlier than usual, and without having tea, went at 8 o'clock in the morning to the church for the morning service and the confession. There was no one in church but a beggar soldier, 2 old women, and the churchmen, a young deacon whose long back showed in 2 distinct halves through his thin undercassock met him, and at once going to a little table at the wall read the exhortations. During the reading, especially at the frequent and rapid repetition of the same words, "Lord, have mercy on us," which sounded like, "Mercy on us, Lord," Levin felt that his thought was shut and sealed up, and that it must not be touched or stirred now, or else confusion would be the result. And so, standing behind the deacon, he went on thinking of his own affairs, neither listening nor examining what was said. "It's wonderful what expression there is in her hand," he thought, remembering how they had been sitting the day before at a corner table. They had nothing to talk about, as was almost always the case at this time. And laying her hand on the table, she kept opening and shutting it, and laughed herself as she watched her action. He remembered how he had kissed her hand, and then had examined the lines on the pink palm. "Another mercy on us, Lord," thought Levin, crossing himself, bowing, and looking at the subtle spring of the deacon's back bowing before him. "She took my hand then and examined the lines. 'You've got a splendid hand,' she said, and he looked at his own hand and the short hand of the deacon. Yes, now it will soon be over," he thought. "No, it seems to be starting up again," he thought, listening to the prayers. "No, it's just ending. There he is, bowing down to the ground. That's always at the end." The deacon's hand and a plush cuff unobtrusively accepted a 3-ruble note, and the deacon said he would put Levin's name down in the register. And his new boots creaking jauntily over the flagstones of the empty church, he went to the altar. A moment later, he peeped out thence and beckoned to Levin. Thought, till then locked up, began to stir in Levin's head, but he made haste to drive it away. "It will come right somehow," he thought, and went toward the ambo. He went up the steps and, turning to the right, saw the priest. The priest, a little ancient with a scanty, grizzled beard and weary, good-natured eyes, was standing at the lectern, turning over the pages of a missal. With a slight bow to Levin, he began immediately reading prayers in an accustomed voice. When he had finished them, he bowed down to the ground and turned, facing Levin. "Christ is present here unseen, receiving your confession," he said, pointing to the crucifix. "Do you believe in all the doctrines of the Holy Apostolic Church?" the priest went on, turning his eyes away from Levin's face and folding his hands under his stole. I have doubted everything," said Levin in a voice that charged on himself, and he ceased speaking. The priest waited a few seconds to see if he would not say more, and closing his eyes, he said quickly with a broad Vladimirsky accent, "Doubt is natural to the weakness of mankind, but we must pray that God in his mercy will strengthen us. What are your special sins?" he added, without the slightest interval, as though anxious not to waste time. "My chief sin is doubt. I have doubts of everything, and for the most part I am in doubt." "Doubt is natural to the weakness of mankind," the priest repeated the same words. "What do you doubt about principally?" "I doubt everything. I sometimes even have doubts of the existence of God," Levin could not help saying, and he was horrified at the impropriety of what he was saying. But Levin's words did not, it seemed, make much impression on the priest. "What sort of doubt can there be of the existence of God?" he said hurriedly, with a barely perceptible smile. Levin did not speak. "What doubt can you have of the Creator when you behold his creation?" the priest went on in the rapid customary recitative. "Who has decked the heavenly firmament with its lights? Who has clothed the earth in its beauty? How explain it without the Creator?" he said, looking inquiringly at Levin. Levin felt that it would be improper to enter upon a metaphysical discussion with the priest, and so he said in reply merely what was a direct answer to the question. "I don't know," he said. "You don't know? Then how can you doubt that God created all?" the priest said with good-humored perplexity. "I don't understand it at all," said Levin, blushing and feeling that his words were stupid, and that they could not be anything but stupid in such a position. "Pray to God and beseech him. Even the Holy Fathers had doubts and prayed to God to strengthen their faith. The devil has great power, and we must resist him. Pray to God, beseech him, pray to God," he repeated hurriedly. The priest paused for some time as though meditating. "You, I hear, are about to marry the daughter of my parishioner, and son in the spirit, Prince Shcherbatsky," he resumed without a smile, "an excellent young lady." "Yes," answered Levin, blushing for the priest. "What does he want to ask me about this at confession for?" he thought. And as though answering his thought, the priest said to him, "You are about to enter into holy matrimony, and God may bless you with offspring. Are you? Well, what sort of bringing up can you give your babies, if you do not overcome the temptation of the devil, enticing you to infidelity," he said with gentle reproachfulness. "If you love your child as a good father, you will not desire only wealth, luxury, honor for your infant. You will be anxious for his salvation, his spiritual enlightenment with the light of truth. Eh? What answer will you make him when the innocent babe asks you, 'Papa, who made all that enchants me in this world? The earth, the waters, the sun, the flowers, and grass.' Can you say to him, 'I don't know'? You cannot but know, since the Lord God in his infinite mercy has revealed it to us. Or your child will ask you, 'What awaits me in the life beyond the grave?' What will you say to him when you know nothing? How will you answer him? Will you leave him to the allurements of the world and the devil?" "That's not right," he said, and he stopped, putting his head on one side and looking at Levin with his kindly, gentle eyes. Levin